come as a result of this state.
Conference record has joined the conference.
For healthcare purposes.
That's one. And then the second is, Marlene brought up the point that the recommendations of the MRT are supposed to take into consideration the consequences on disadvantaged populations or health disparities. And reflecting on that, other than past comments about the consequences on individuals, we did not have a full discussion of that topic. Reflecting on that further, it's not clear that we know much about what the consequences of that would be, but I just want to make sure that we have that noted, and if there are comments about that that others would wish to put in the record, feel free to do so now. Art.
So it's just the form that the concerns that were expressed go forward to the MRT. I mean, is it sort of saying, okay, this is a recommendation, but there was a lot of discussion and
Well, I think that
real concern about and be specific about what those concerns are.
I think we will do that. I think the other question is just on, to fulfill the spirit of the MRT rules of engagement. We did not have an extended discussion about the consequences of the dual eligible strategy for the populations that Marlene brought up. So I'm making that observation. I don't know that there's more for us to do about it other than to note that we had no particular observations about that in passing the resolution. Marlene, do you want to comment?
I think that the item one, which was voted very much by the majority in the affirmative, but with loyal opposition and serious conversation and dissent, not benefiting from any analysis of how this affects certain populations. Between now and the written report, I think perhaps the department could give us some data on how this affects those populations as the MRT instructions require, and the vote is a conditional vote.
Well, the vote is a vote. I mean, we can ask the department to... The vote is a vote. We can ask the department to do that. I would note, as you did, that it was not an extended discussion. Okay, thank you for those two observations. Pat, you want to move ahead now?
Sure, thank you. The next is potential recommendation number two, quality measurement. Adopt a series of accepted performance measures across all sectors of healthcare. In parentheses, managed care, ACOs, BHLs, health homes. Aligning measures already being collected in New York State and Medicaid managed care, including managed long-term care, with federal requirements. So the goals would be the need to utilize a core set of measures that are flexible to address the evolving delivery system, be based on standard of care or evidence-based science, implement public reporting process on measures and outcomes, and reward providers for both improvement and continued high performance. So some of these we actually already talked about under the principal guide slides earlier.
I have a question.
Yes.
The reference to Medicaid managed care, including MLTC, managed long-term care with federal reach, why is it only managed long-term care being referenced there?
Why? I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering why only managed long-term care is referenced. I mean, are we referring to the mandatory enrollment for the home care population? Because that is still an open debate within that work group as to what those other care coordination models are.
This is not about models, and it could be the way we worded this.
Okay.
It's really aligning measures that we're already collecting in Medicaid managed care and managed long-term care with the federal requirements.
Okay.
So I may need a comma or something in there to straighten that out a little bit. It's not about models of care. It's really aligning what we're already doing in Medicaid managed care and managed long-term care across
okay.
other sectors.
But you wouldn't want to also expand it to also align those same performance measures for other models that may be utilized in the system?
Absolutely. We could put the CCMs in the parentheses.
Yeah, I mean, CCMs
yeah.
are still an open debate
right.
within that work group.
We can add that to parentheses, isn't it?
Thank
that's
you.
That's not all-inclusive. I think that's probably an error on our part.
Okay.
Phyllis.
I think that when we do quality measures, we need to someplace in here talk about recognizing different populations or differences in patients. And I don't know exactly where it belongs in here, but I think we need to acknowledge that. And the other piece is on the last item where it says rewards for providers for improved and continued high performance. We may want and or because it may be for improvement and it may not be yet high performance on somebody.
Can I just get a clarifying on your first comment on recognizing different populations? Can you give me a little bit more on there just so I understand it?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm not as close to it, but I think people who deal with quality more, the severity adjustments, the different, you know, whether there are different adjustments that you want to make when you're doing these quality measurements. And I'm not as close to it. That was my impression that there were.
No, I mean, it depends what you're measuring, and the contentiousness here is you can risk adjust to your advantage. I mean, you can risk adjust away the real differences in performance. It's very complicated. So I don't know how much in this very general statement, you know, how much detail there needs to be.
That's what you're saying. It's okay. Recognizing.
Right.
Risk or differences in the populations or
so. I'm trying to you know think about whether there's a way to express this simply because what you would do in looking at a proposed measure is say what is it proposing to measure, what's the denominator, what's the numerator, what's the population, and then you make, you know, decisions about what the right. So it gets sort of technical, measure by measure. So I'm sort of fumbling around. How do you make some sort of general statement on? I mean, what we're talking about is the appropriateness of the measure,
right.
really. That it's appropriate for who and what is being measured.
So you're talking about population measures primarily here?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, certainly I hear it more about individual services around from a provider perspective.
As an example, I think Greg is talking about doing an assessment of health that's based on a social assessment.
Functional status, yes.
But that's not evidence-based at this point. You're focusing on evidence-based. But can I have a question? Yes.
Please, your mic. Thank you.
My question is, when we talk about performance measures across all sectors, it seems to me these are provider sectors, right? Are you talking about providers?
The traditional healthcare sectors, correct. Traditional healthcare sectors, so hospitals, health plans.
So that's where I can, you kind of talk about managed care, ACOs, BHOs,
right.
health homes.
Right.
It's just not clear to me.
What's not clear? All sectors?
These are, if you go back to some of the other slides, these are the care management approaches that we're using
okay.
going forward, but it's not necessarily representative of all the provider sectors at this time.
It's not all inclusive, I agree.
Yeah. So shouldn't the quality measures be across the board?
I agree.
All providers?
So would we suggest scratching the parenthetic?
Yeah,
it's all mm-hmm. sectors
Fine.
That provide services. Fine.
Mm-hmm. You can do that. That's good. That's a good pickup. Other comments on this recommendation?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, thanks. I guess I would recommend, and it gets to Phyllis's point, perhaps we need an additional bullet if there's something to the effect that takes into consideration patient severity or acuity. That gets the risk adjustment component, which is so critical here. And you know, just I guess one question. I mean, it's clear to me here we're not reinventing any wheels. We are using mechanisms that already exist and trying to apply them across the board. Correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
I think this is. So let me just state what I think on that. The slippery slope, and Art alluded to this, depending on the measure, risk adjustment is appropriate, and others it may not be, depending on the situation. So we may need to hedge that if you want to put that in.
Yeah, I mean, you can say, you know, taking into consideration where appropriate.
Right. Okay. And I think a good quick example is we want hemoglobin A1C testing for all diabetics, whether they're a very low severity or, you know, bedridden in the nursing home. We want it done. So that's a process measure. We don't want that severity or functional status to risk adjust out, so to speak, differences.
So. Like his performance. I mean, shouldn't be an excuse for poor performance.
Correct. So we can put something in an additional bullet on adjustment.
Yeah.
Steve?
Just to be clear, I think we're discussing two issues. We're discussing comorbidities or clinical risk adjustment, and we're discussing socioeconomic status. They're separate and different, and we need to draw a bright line on that. A patient with diabetes and heart disease and asthma has comorbidities but is different than the same patient who's is in a family that makes $100,000 a year. So we should be clear that we're looking at socioeconomic status and adjusting, and for comorbidities. Dartmouth Atlas only does one. It doesn't do socioeconomic status, and it's misleading because of that.
Yeah, Steve, could I just ask, I mean, is that a realistic goal for the Medicaid program, that we would be adjusting all our quality measures for socioeconomic status? I mean, I'm not against it. I'm just wondering about the practicality.
I think it is realistic. I think it's harder to do. It is a cohort, I understand. But it should be paid attention to. There are different communities. There are different challenges. There are people in the Medicaid program that are middle class. How can I say it differently?
And as case in point, I mean, they are developing a method in Health Homes, example, to do that with the functional status assessment. It's new, but it's something that we should, as a goal, we talk about vision goals.
Okay. Emma, then Pat.
I think that if you don't address the functional issues and the social issues, you're not going to make a dent on the clinical. You're not going to make a dent on the clinical issues. I think they're tied together, and I think they are hard to capture. But I know, particularly with the HIV population, that's very, very critical. My comment is on bullet number 3. It talks about implementing a public reporting process. There are already outcome measures that are published for various areas, like for the nursing home, have the nursing home compare, or OASIS data for home care. So I think that there are already things in place that you may want to continue to use or improve in addition to new measures.
Totally agree.
Comment, Pat?
I just wanted to make the comment that I think that people should, like a risk adjustment for functional status or complexity or socioeconomic can often affect how much you get paid, and that's risk adjustment for the payment stream. But to Pat's point, you know, I mean, there are certain measures. You don't want to risk adjust that somebody's blood sugar is controlled or, you know, adult BMI was reported and smoking cessation. I mean, there are certain things that, you know, I think that the state is entitled to buy for its Medicaid dollars, and that should not be risk adjusted. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag. And, you know, Patrick, you know that I have issues about the PQI for asthma measure, that is not adjusted for environmental issues. So I just want to make that thing, because I think people are confusing the concept. You get, if the person is more complex, you get paid more to make sure that their blood sugar is controlled, let's
right.
say.
Right.
But you still need to get that, hit that measure. Why should you compromise on that?
Marlene?
I have a point where I think it's relevant. And with the discussion we had the last meeting about the preventable admissions and the preventable readmissions, I think the socioeconomic factors really do weigh in on your success in achieving those metrics. A clinician, please help me.
I don't think there's any doubt about that validity. I mean, could I have a comment, Pat, in terms of your capability of offering these measures?
Well, I think we will need help on defining it. And this is not an easy thing to define. The Medicaid program obviously is almost stratified by poor people. There is obviously middle class for the DD, for example, skip one.
I'm not arguing about the validity of the concept or the need. It's the practicality of linking that into our recommendation and having it implementable, if I may use that word.
I agree that it's hard, but I think if you have a person who is homeless and lacks housing, you could provide the best medical care, and your outcomes are not going
to
be.
That's why you need to adjust.
Right. So, and I think it is hard to measure, but I think that we have to consider them.
So are there other comments on these modified quality measurements, principles, or recommendations that are made these changes? Straightforward in terms of our ability to make the change, understand the addition. Other discussion on the comfort level in the group that would allow us to move these forward to the full MRP, and does this cover these special populations? Have we covered that enough in our discussion about this? Okay. All right. So we covered that obligation. Those in favor of this participation, as you understand it to be modified, and you will be able to confirm it at some time, raise your hand. Those opposed. Okay. So this recommendation, as rephrased and reapproved by two males that are approved. Thank you. All right. Now. Potential recommendation number three.
Okay, what we've done here is develop a recommendation, a general recommendation on principles that can be used for disproportionate share payments. As we explained in the two prior meetings, that we're still waiting for direction from CMS, federal government, on how to proceed. So we've got a general principle, we've got goals, and then we took a stab at developing general principles, which is going to be the second slide of this particular recommendation that we feel can be used in any approach to revising the DISH program. So the recommendation would be develop general principles that can be applied towards revising the New York State DISH Indigent Care Program, with the caveat that these principles can be applied once CMS provides guidance for determining how state allocations of federal DISH funding will be reduced as part of the federal reform. So the goals that we've established, the first goal would be develop a new allocation methodology consistent with CMS guidelines that will be forthcoming, to ensure that New York State does not take more than its share of the nationwide reduction. In the previous meetings, we've given you some information as to what we feel will be New York's projected decrease in the allocation. The second goal would be a fair and equitable approach to allocate funds across hospitals, with a greater proportion of funds allocated to those hospitals that provide service to the underinsured. And then the third goal that we've identified would be to simplify the allocation methodology and consolidate pools. I'll cover the draft principles, and then we'll open it up to the floor for discussion. So on the next slide, the draft principles that we put together, number one
is a statement pretty much that it's critical for all New York State health interests to advocate against further cuts in federal funding for DISH and other programs for eligible consumers and providers. Number two, New York State should make changes in its uncompensated care pool allocations consistent with CMS guidelines to preserve its share of available federal DISH funding. Number three, subject to federal guidelines, the components of need and valuing the uncompensated care support should be primarily based on charity care and uncompensated care to low-income, uninsured, and underinsured patients, but exclude bad debt. Number four, the current methodology has lost its progressivity. New York needs to allocate funds across providers with a greater proportion of funds to those with higher need. And number five, the state should include public hospital essential community provider funding under a waiver to mitigate shortfalls caused by reductions in federal DISH funding. So we're trying to preserve the funding for the public hospitals. So we'll open up to discussion.
So the recommendation is to develop general principles that can be applied towards revising. Let's get all the key words in here. General principles applied towards revising the program. And then we have the principles. So I'll open it for discussion. Steve.
Just one suggestion, because I think you're almost there, but it could be stronger on the first point, which is that the current methodology for taking DISH down is tied to newly insured in the country. And New York, especially New York City, doesn't behave like the rest of the country in healthcare reform because of the lack of immigration reform that we have. So undocumented are precluded from being in the pools and or, the way I understand it, in the 90% funded Medicaid side of the house. So there is a target on precluding undocumented immigrants. So the more you can be specific to hospitals and or micro regions, I think you preserve the DISH better, because if you go to the whole country, you're basically transferring the money to Iowa. If you go to the whole state of New York, you're preserving a level of funding, but it's not sensitive enough to adjust for the lack of the upside in healthcare reform. So I would go to, in fact, hospital specific specificity on that issue, and not just the general.
Marlene.
I just want to say procedurally, I have the proposal that was adopted by the Disparities Committee to hand out, so you can actually compare and line committees. I just would like to thank you. I think this is really great. These principals really kind of took this issue head on, and I think it would take the state in the right direction. I agree with Steve on his point, if I understood it correctly, that in saying that New York's share should be lower in a sense, because we're not likely to get the benefit of healthcare reform of other states, both because of the undocumented issue, but I think even more importantly, because our Medicaid levels were already so high that we don't get the benefit of the nationwide Medicaid level, which is going to bring certain states well up. So I think that we ought to be advocating in a public document that New York really shouldn't take cuts or should take minimal cuts because of those factors.
Phyllis.
Oh, I have a few comments. One of the things to think about maybe is we've talked about the uninsured and the underinsured, and I don't know if the intent is to include Medicaid, which are really a large underinsured population. If you think about it, most people are getting, I think it's in the 70% range of their cost structure on Medicaid. And I wonder whether that needs to be included in the need analysis when you're doing distribution, whether that would be okay with the feds. I'm not sure. So,
ACA encourages states to have their formulas, and I think you have it in a bullet, but maybe it needs to be spelled out in terms of the weighting. they encourage you to wait.
Well, it's later on when they talk about the progressive nature, I think, in the attachment.
Yeah, you certainly could be more explicit about it.
So I think the whole issue of whether Medicaid losses are really included in this is part of it. The second piece that I'd be concerned about is the consolidation of the pools, and I'm not sure what that means. There are segregated pools now for high need and different special gizmos. I don't even remember what they are. There are lots of them. And then there's also the public versus the private sector. And I would particularly not be in favor of merging the private and the public sector pools at this point, given that there are other mechanisms to fund on the public sector side. And I suspect that if you just put them together and use the methodology, that would move money. And I think that would be a significant problem in the private sector. So if you go to the principles, I think those two principles are, again, in three, in item three, the question is whether Medicaid fits into that, Medicaid losses. And then in four and five, the issue of that consolidation of pools. And to be honest with you, I didn't understand five. Now, I understand if you're hitting Medicaid dish, there's an issue that needs help to fix. But I wasn't sure if that's what that was doing or whether it was actually merging those pools. So,
well, I think it's an attempt to preserve the funding for the public hospital sector. You know, we do an IGT payment up to the dish cap, but if we get to a situation where the dish cap is lowered, say why, we want to be able to preserve the amount of money that we can funnel to the public hospital sector on that.
But then if we hit the cap and there were monies, I'm making it up, to say $50 million less was available, are you suggesting that the public sector be held harmless and then that $50 million would come out of the private sector?
So if we hit the cap and say the public sector doesn't get 100% of their cap, of their cap, if we can reserve it, that funding level through a waiver, similar to what California does, then you know we can provide assistance to the public sector.
They're trying to eliminate that competition. But I think I need to say this sort of for this group, and maybe the department, who knows the data better than I don't know, what proportion of the provision of care to this population is now being provided by the public sector as opposed to the private sector? The uninsured.
I don't know. Two-thirds of the pool, yeah.
We can find that out.
I think that's certainly is an important data element to this discussion.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think what we can do is we get reported on our cost report, you know, the number of people that are uninsured that were served, and we can break that out by inpatient, ER. So we'll put together, you know, a quick chart on that.
But in the end, it really is all under insurance because the uninsured, there are recoveries. They're different in the public sector than in the private sector. Whether you have insurance, no insurance, or you're on Medicaid, the issue is still under insurance. That's the cardinal issue. It's because you could look at what you just asked for, Marlene, but you still need to know what was recovered in pools. So what I'm really saying is that the issue that we need to be fair about and to preserve is the federal rate on the dish money. You have that here. And two, how we use it, and the issue is underinsurance, not uninsurance rate. I spend a lot of money getting people on Medicaid because I don't do very well if I don't. As much as I spend, I get a little more back.
I'm kind of looking at you confused because the definition of underinsurance is when a person doesn't have a full benefits package. It's not when a rate doesn't meet a provider's cost. By anybody's stretch of the imagination, the definition of that. And there is, and the reason why we need the CMS guidance is given the dish audit, there's a possibility that CMS is not going to entertain formulas that include anybody that has any kind of insurance. So I think the department rightfully is trying to preserve the funding and trying to preserve the care. And let's go back to the disparities group and where they weighed in on this. This is really about providing care. And as you pointed out, we have a population that has not benefited from any kind of immigration reform, who, but for this, have no place to go. So this is really important.
This is Dan. Can I chime in?
Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want a couple of observations. One, I think I'm not certain yet what the federal government will say about not providing any allowance in its methodology for people who have any kind of insurance, because I'm very worried about the implementation of once we get the exchanges going, that we're going to have the we're going to have these different models of platinum, gold, silver, bronze. When you get to the bronze category of plans, those that will be most likely purchased by low-income people whose employers may have even terminated insurance in order to send them to the exchange and save money, they'll most likely apply for those plans with the highest deductibles. And the distinction, in my mind, is not so much whether they're insured and uninsured, black and white, but whether or not they're willing or unable to pay, those high deductibles. So when the federal government, in my mind, says you can't include bad debt, you can only include uncompensated care minus bad debt, they're saying uncompensated care is more than just charity. It could be people who, I think it could be, people who have extremely high deductibles or extremely high co-payments and now have no ability to pay them. And it's that group that I want to make sure gets in, because I think that group is going to expand as we implement health reform. So when we look at, you know, the federal government, we know they're going to cut us, right? They're already committed to cutting us in Medicaid under the prior Affordable Care Act. Accountable Care Act. But if they cut us more, either from the select committee in Washington that decides it can, in fact, put a package together, so now it's not just 2% of Medicare, now they could get into Medicaid as well. They could cut provider taxes, making it harder on the states. This combination of threatening forces that we can't quite define precisely yet is going to put more and more pressure on whatever dollars are left right in the pool. So what I want to make sure is that we have some prioritization in mind, that certainly charity care goes first, that those unable to pay go next, you know, and then if you want to count Medicaid, we can count Medicaid, but it could be a methodology like almost the Medicaid disproportionate share methodology for distributing the money, rather than it being a needs test. Because what I'm worried about is, if, you know, we get so many huge applications for need based upon Medicaid, and then we don't end up providing it predominantly to those taking care of the charity care and those unable to pay. So in my mind, the methodology, whether it's units of service, whether it's a Medicaid disproportionate share formula, how much of it counts toward meeting the federal government's insistence on its criteria? Can you use a correlation? Can you use a zip code identification of poverty areas instead of tracking each patient? There's so much to be decided here. And at the end of the day, you have to know at least a general sense of the impacts, because you can do substantial damage here. So I'm okay with the principles, although I should probably caveat that in my mind, when we originally had the discussion, I think it was two meetings ago, about all of the pools, when we went through that litany of these, what in my mind I would call special purpose pools, it was at that point the department said we ought to consolidate and simplify the pools. So I view that language about going to the pools as still, at least initially, keeping the voluntary and public separate, trying to maximize the amount of money we can bring in, protect what comes, maximize what we can bring in, funnel it in a way that goes to those who provide the charity care and the indigent or unable to pay, whatever you want to call it, category. And then try, we could leave out public hospital if you want when we talk about going to maximize support from a waiver. But I think the intent is to if the pools are kept separate, try to maintain the public hospital level as high, as close to where it can to current levels. And if all that fails, then we probably have to revisit the whole issue and talk about, you know, consolidating a whole lot of pools and shrinking them down. But a going in position, you know, I think we have to be a little careful not to try and get everything we want here, because if we make the need so great, the dollars aren't going to be there to cover it.
Another comment. It seems to me document is going to have the word misfit.
The only point I mentioned is that, you know, if the need is so great, what it does is it allocates an allocation methodology. The dollars are the dollars, and that's all that's available. So I'm not so sure that, you know, expanding the definition of the need is, to me, an issue, because we're not going to meet 100% of it.
Right. So that's why I would like to – I think you could handle it better on the distribution end.
But I do think, as you point out, that it is important to – in the document, keep the public and the voluntary sector pools separated.
Okay. Yes, certainly.
So I don't know if this would be in the general principles or the general draft principles, but it seems to me that there needs to be some principle about transparency and accountability. And I know that's reflected in some of the principles here, but I wonder if that wouldn't be helpful as just a clear statement, knowing that this is a big challenge in terms of how you make this transparent.
I'm trying to understand Rhonda's point. I think I do. When you talk about transparency, are you getting to hospital provider transparency? In the way in which they count for the use of their dollars or not?
Yes. That the dollars can be tied to services, to individuals, that we know what we're paying for in this case.
Okay.
We look at it as another payer.
No, I agree with you. I just want to make sure I understood it that way, and that part of the principles, therefore, if I understand what you're suggesting, and I think I agree with it,
right,
is that a part of the goals that this not be – that the state should take a lead role in providing the template to be required for the reporting of these dollars. Right now, it's internal cost report.
Right.
It all comes up the ICR, which my understanding is audited by each individual provider's auditors.
That is correct. And hospitals are pursuant to federal requirements are undergoing audits, dish audits, that's been going on for the past couple of years to verify the data.
I realize that.
Yep.
Going forward, rather than do it in a retroactive basis, perhaps it could be a goal to try and make this open and transparent from the get-go so that the hospitals are not accountable for their own data to some extent.
Yeah, I think that's certainly fine. I mean, the reason why we use the two-year data is because it just takes time for it to get recorded, right, and audited. There's been ideas that have been, you know, kicked around about whether if it goes on the basis of uninsured on a real-time basis, there could be claims submitted, you know, for each uninsured, you know, patient that's served, and then that would keep the data real-time. So it really, how we work that out depends on what the methods are.
I mean, I'm not speaking into detail. I'm just trying to understand Lon's point, and I agree with it, that there does need to be openness and transparency to how these dollars are accounted for.
And if they go to the populations, they're tied to the populations who use the services and the services that are produced, and not simply an allocation methodology.
Well, this is Dan. You know, we also have to, while we can criticize the existing methodology easily because it's not very traceable and it does include bad debt and it isn't progressive, you know, there's failings with all these methodologies, and a major failing of the unit of service methodology is that it doesn't incorporate uncompensated care losses for low-income uninsured, underinsured, if you will. And most of the uncompensated care from underinsured today you would find in a bad debt box. Now, you know, as time goes by, we're not going to cover and and the feds will require us not to count the bad debt. But, you know, I still want to make the argument that we've got to protect that category of losses from low-income uninsured, because I think that population is going to swell.
Marlene?
Yeah, I have a point of clarification for Phil and John and his team. My understanding was there was a problem or there's an issue of detail that we needed clarification from CMS because of the DISH audit, and because in the DISH audit, CMS very stringently insisted that anybody that has insurance could not be counted in any way, shape, or form. That being said, if somebody has insurance, but their insurance doesn't cover a particular service, or they can't afford their coinsurance and deductible, there is, in fact, a difference between bad debt and charity care in that arena, and that has to do with whether or not the hospital has reduced their fees for this service that's not covered and or reduced their coinsurance and deductible obligation because of their income. And that piece of it, the amount of dollars that the hospitals write off to charity care, because they've actually said, you know, you poor person who got a bronze plan, you can't afford that 30% copay. We understand that we're only going to charge you 5%. That 25% is charity care. That can be distinguished. I just thought our issue was that the feds are not, you know, not looking kindly on that in the DISH audit.
Well, I guess we're probably where we get to find out.
I think I agree. I think we're still, and this is why the direction is so important, because we're not even sure what the connection will be between the DISH audit and what they prescribe as the preferred approach for states to make allocations. We just don't know. And we've actually, as part of the DISH audit process, you know, I think I may have mentioned last time, at one point they were not going to allow us to count GME costs. Right, and we were asking them, what are you doing about counting GME costs? Those are true costs. So I think, you know, we really, you know, hopefully they'll come out with enough, you know, definition that we can actually craft a new method. I mean, I think as that information comes out, I think we should weigh in terms of what we think from New York State's perspective, right, those definitions mean. Just, you know, so we're clear from the beginning. But I think, and I'll just stop, but I think we have meetings, weekly meetings with CMS. Our question is, you know, how far off are we? Because this is important for us.
I just would like to clarify for the group, you can have charity care, and that charity care is the amount that you have discounted the patient's responsibility. So in the world with the bronze plan, if a hospital is going to make itself accessible to a particular patient with bronze plan by allowing them to fee scale to their income, that could be part of a formula. I think the issue is in the CMS getting them there to accept that, and I think that's more possible than what's traditionally bad debt, which is simply someone didn't pay their bill or an insurance company didn't pay their bill. I want a question to the department. When you put the bullet down on the consolidation, did you mean to be including the publics and the voluntaries, and if so, what was your thinking? Were you just referring to the specialty pool?
It was just, we were trying to, if you look back to one of the slides we had in the very first presentation that we did, the complication of all those small various pools that have stayed in effect for 15, 20 years, we thought it would be easy if you consolidated and in a new allocation methodology, eliminated all of those various pools, but it's not the intent to combine the public and private funding together into one.
But it was the intent on that final goal to immunize the public from the DISH as much as possible through a.
Correct. We will explore that.
So if I could just try to summarize the ideas that have come out here, and particularly Marlene's question and Phil's clarification. I don't want to try to wordsmith this for the group. I just want to make sure the ideas are here. So number one seems fairly acceptable. Number two, with Phil's clarification, there might be some language that says, you know, distribution to public and private might be in there just to clarify that point. Number three, and this is where I think Dan's point that, and I'm just asking both in terms of Marlene's observations and Dan's point, that if, why would we not put in as much as possible? Charity care, unable to pay, Medicaid, and uncompensated until we get it clarified. This doesn't seem to me it would hurt to put all that in there. Some of that will be clarified with the discussion. So we could just put all that in. Marlene, you, no.
I think you do need to add in the appropriate critical context. When you said Medicaid is not part of that language.
I'm sorry?
Bill, when you were rereading the kind of newer version of 3, you said Medicaid, although it's not in the current version of 3, but I think Medicaid belongs in 4. I think just as a technical matter.
Oh, I was just quoting Dan. He had three groups: charity care, unable to pay, Medicaid. Dan, you had a specific Medicaid subgroup you had referenced there.
Yeah, I think that you're only allowed to put them through the progressivity, right?
I was putting Medicaid in 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
In any case, I'll stand to the opinion of those who know more than I on this nuance here. But the concept would be that we would load it up, at least in our initial argument. The loss of progressivity, why are we so self-condemnatory here? What if we just say we can take that line out, no flagellation required here of our own effort?
You could just say needs to be more progressive.
That's a positive way of putting it. Thank you. Right. 5, comments on 5. Rhonda thought there should be something here about transparency and accountability of this process.
And maybe add something in to basically you're trying to mitigate any shortfalls to the public sector, but maybe not at the expense of the other sectors or other healthcare sectors. I mean, that is the goal.
I have an objection to that because I think we are the safety net in this sphere, and we do provide such a substantial amount of care that I think that for once it ought to be a priority. You know, I'm just going to make that as a statement.
Okay. Well, we have our first recommendation that is in dispute. Rick?
Yeah, and again, I think that once we begin to go down the road of robbing Peter to pay Paul, we're making a serious mistake, and we're pointing our guns in. So I would not endorse that. I've got the same deal with my primary care versus my specialist, and I would be supportive of 5 so long as we would push for more dollars for the public health sector, hospital sector, but certainly not at the expense of anyone else, either at the same plane or down the healthcare continuum.
Well, if I could take Marlene's strategy and turn it into a positive here, could we say that we would hope to secure funds to protect both sectors?
I'm fine with that.
It's a goal. I mean, it is a principle we would like to see. It doesn't, and I'm just offering this to the group. I'm just trying to get us off this page with some agreement. So
right now, I don't see where you have competition in both 5. So why are you interjecting the privates in there? I just would like to say that this is just saying that the state should pursue a waiver to protect the funding for the public hospitals that provide a significant amount of care. I don't know the exact number. I don't want to say majority, to the folks that this bullet is intended to address. That's all this is saying. It doesn't say it's taking it away from anybody. You've now had somebody ask that it be included as long as it doesn't take anything away from anybody. Now, there's always a political capital. There might be, should we lobby for this or not lobby for that? And this is all this is saying is do this. It's not saying any competition here.
I agree, it is not. And I'm not espousing competition. So right now we have 6 recommendations that have been wordsmithed somewhere along the lines I have articulated. and only six. And number five is not modified as it stands right now. Is there more discussion on Phyllis?
Yeah, I guess I'm not clear why we would not, why you'd be uncomfortable with not at the expense of other parts of the healthcare
system. Because
sector.
It wasn't intended to be at the expense of, and it has nothing to do with the rest of the entity.
Right.
But I find it, frankly, kind of odd. And this is the principal section, not the recommendation section that we're reading.
I would clarify. I was not, the suggestion I made was not for number five. It was as an additional item.
What's the additional item?
The additional item would be something to the effect that our principles would be that we would hope that we would secure these funding that would be protective of all enterprises and not to the well, just stop there. That would be our goal as a principle. It doesn't deal with five. Marlene, I think your point on that is correct. This would be an incorrect place to put that. I'm just putting it in as a principle to protect both groups, essentially. Say that our goal is to protect.
How about protect the access to care for the uninsured that won't be covered with health care reform in both sectors, who are receiving care in either sector? Why don't we put the patient on here?
Dan, I think that makes sense because as we worded number five right now, we're talking about essential community providers.
Right.
And we're about to have another discussion about what an essential community provider is, which may be distinct from what we mean about DISH. So doing it the way she just said is probably cleaner given where we're going.
As an additional item, Dan?
No, in lieu of five.
In lieu of five, say... Okay, I'm not sure that's what Marlene was saying.
Number five, and I asked the department to speak of, is similar to the support from this committee to seek a waiver on the dual eligibles. This is support from this committee to include the public, just like California was included, in a waiver so that the DISH funding, the IGP funding is preserved. It has nothing to do with the pools. It has nothing to do with the voluntaries. It's intended to immunize a provider category that is very much needed, particularly in light of all the things that are likely to happen. I would support a bullet that would say something about, and in order to secure, you know, that care is provided to the uninsured and underinsured, we should advocate for preservation for funds for all sectors. That's fine.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just saying we're about to say that we're about to talk about voluntary essential community providers. If we can get some federal money for them, too, that would be good.
So in California, there was a special part of their waiver package that accomplished what you just said. So I support that.
Yeah.
I support that.
So that's a six.
I think it is. I think you leave it. I think you add your number six, which says we want to preserve all the money for these purposes.
Yeah.
But yours is really aimed at hitting a cap, and you need relief
right.
from
no,
that.
I'm
and that should be in the waiver.
I'm with Marlene on five. I'm just six she has articulated. Seven is now Rhonda's. Is there an eight? Hearing no eight. Money for all. Right. No, I know. It's all right. Money for all. Okay. So those are our principles as modified and articulated. Is there more discussion on the principles, which in turn would come back to recommendation number three, which would be that we would pursue that these principles would be used to devise our new New York State DISH Indigent Care Program. So we are voting on recommendation number three, which is deeply entwined with the principles we have so refined here. Further discussion? Hearing none, those who would favor recommendation number three? Thank you.
And I'm on the phone too now. It's
Dan and Mike. Did you vote?
Jim also.
Okay. All right. Potential recommendation number four.
I'll try that one. Last one. So we're getting there. I think, you know, we talked about this before. I think that this, you know, recommendation stems from the fact that there's
obviously a significant amount of pressure on the healthcare system, not only from a financing perspective, but also in just in terms of all the reform initiatives that, you know, are being discussed here as well as at other tables. When we initially included this as part of our charge, we know that there's a lot of work going on by Mr. Berger and the Brooklyn Group, and our discussions were about trying to create flexible funding streams to promote the changes that are underway, you know, in Brooklyn. We discussed, you know, the need to have, you know, what we call, you know, tools in the toolbox. These would be things that, you know, the community can use to help accomplish their reform goals. We typically refer to as, you know, HEAL dollars. We got a new outlay of HEAL funds. Those will be instrumental. We also introduced this concept of a temporary rate adjustment. Again, this would be more or less to accomplish the operating side of changes that may go on between a merger or consolidation or downsizing. And we've had discussions with CMS about this concept. They viewed it as very favorable. They thought that these dollars could be, you know, important in terms of driving change. One of the concepts we were very clear with them about is that, you know, these dollars will only flow pursuant to a plan. So if a hospital or a nursing home, a clinic, and we've added home care, if a provider feels as if, you know, they're struggling, they're in need of additional financing, that it would only be approved by the commissioner in the event that there's a plan that's adopted with clear benchmarks in terms of how these dollars will be used and what the expected outcomes are. This cannot be viewed. It has the potential to be quite a slippery slope, but these dollars cannot be viewed as, you know, something that would promote or continue an inefficiency. So we're operating under a global cap. The global cap tremendously changes the dynamics here because we don't want to be in a position where we're over the global cap. We're outlaying, you know, tremendous amounts of money under this initiative, and in essence, other providers would have to, you know, offer up savings. So we need to be, you know, very, you know, careful as we go forward. Now, we think that these dollars are critical. Having said that, I think at our last meeting, Dr. Cooper had mentioned that, you know, these funds should be more than just temporary in nature. In certain situations, they'll need to be ongoing. And again, pursuant to the same plan, pursuant to the same, you know, fixes. You know, because there'll be a recognition that there's a problem here. There also has to be a recognition that there is a solution. So we've basically modified this proposal to be a little bit larger in scope, meaning that, you know, the time frames of the dollars could be extended. But we're very clear that if we're going to, you know, venture down this path, that, you know, there needs to be, you know, clear benchmarks and guidelines. We've consulted with Laura LaFave and Rick Cook. They're the staff that are helping Mr. Berger. They're in agreement with this recommendation. They're in agreement with these set of goals, which I can go through. And then also to kind of further explain the concept that we've included, you know, a paper here for you to review. But I can go through the goals, just to make sure that folks were clear with what this recommendation would entail. Ensure patient access to provider services that may be otherwise jeopardized by the provider's payer mix or geographic location. Focus should be on essential providers that are not financially viable, provide a disproportionate level of care to financially vulnerable populations, provide essential health care services, and provide a high fraction of health services in their market area. Provide supplemental financial support to ensure that the long-term viability of designated providers. Reinvest a portion of the savings generated from reforms and downsizing within an impacted community to maintain that community's health care delivery system, something that we've discussed here already. Implement review process for designated providers for administrative/operational efficiencies, quality standards, provision of essential services, and potential for integration or collaboration with other entities. That's the plan I mentioned. So that is, you know, in a nutshell, you know, it's in essence the same, you know, recommendation we discussed before, but we've, you know, broadened it some. In the paper, you know, we could go through the paper, but I think I've pretty much, you know, touched upon the major points here.
Comments? Okay, Rick?
Yes, Jeff, and I think you covered this in the goals, but I just want to be clear that this is not advocating for the structural status quo.
That is true.
Okay, so really what you're talking about is that when I look at the goal, it's creating findings and mechanisms that strengthen the financial viability of New York's, and then I would insert efficiently operated essential community provider network, just as a suggestion. So it certainly, and again, I think 4 and 5 make it very clear that you're not advocating for the status quo. And then my next question is that in not doing so, certainly this is not limited to a facility-based setting, but where appropriate, especially, again, when you get into points 4 and 5, where you may have to reconfigure the delivery system in a neighborhood or a community, certainly you'd be looking at community-based providers of care like primary care physicians and seeing how we can, if you will, gather together and group some primary care physicians in the neighborhood to provide the care where the people are rather than requiring the people to come to some central location. Fair point?
It's a fair point. I think when we envision how these plans may, you know, play themselves out, we certainly won't be taking an institutional-centric view. Right. I think, you know, if we're going to put up state tax dollars to help out the institution, it's going to be from a planning framework of the whole community.
Great. Thank you.
Scott and then Steve, then Sue, then Pat. I'll run the table. Go ahead. Scott?
I think I want to, again, mirroring what Marlene said earlier, I want to congratulate you. I think it responded very much to a lot of the issues that were raised previously, particularly pleased that you put about reinvesting a portion of the savings back into the community, because that was a sore point that we brought up the last time. One thing I'd like to wonder, and perhaps it's too detailed for these series of recommendations, but this is not just a question of writing checks. In many cases, access to capital. And these are institutions that may, in fact, have some operational viability if they had access to capital markets. And the state could, I think, rise to that occasion without putting dollars on the table right now. Secured loan processes, government-backed loans, other states have done that, moral obligation bonds, things of that nature are opportunities to help this sector without having to write a check. And I think that obviously there'd be a lot of hoops to go through in the same way that you would expect any creditor to take those things into consideration. I hope that would be a part of these principles. Because it does speak to the fact that we all recognize there's a limited number of dollars available. But that allows us to tap into the private sector and their dollars if the state puts full faith and credit behind it. And I would hope that would be one of the principles we might be able to include. If you think that's too detailed, I'd understand it.
I think the comments you made are weaved in here, but it might be in the at the top, but we'd be very clear that what we're not just talking about a hospital that's failing. We're talking about an assessment of a region with a goal in mind to retool it, reshape it, and make it viable. Otherwise, you know, we're not going to get what we want. And in line with what Scott said, I would suggest, and I think it's very important what he said, is that there's sometimes we look at these issues as if the only issue is the operating margin or the bottom line, and then make a judgment about viability when capital needs or liquidity or reinvestment issues are baked into a failed structure over time. So I would suggest perhaps what we would do is change viable, financially viable, to financially challenged, because I think it gives you more flexibility, and then be specific that it's not just operating margins, but that would be one, but liquidity and capital needs have to be factored into that. You could be operating in the black and have no cash and have no furnace. where the furnace is about to go. Okay, so there, it's a total assessment of needs over time in the context of a region and the region's needs.
Yes, yeah.
Sue? I guess three comments here. I assume that the department always has this. I just want to make sure that the department really has the ability to turn folks away on this. Certainly there's a lot of political pressure on these kinds of moments in time in terms of eligibility, and I would like to see, not everyone in the room may like this, but I would like to see the department have adequate judgment and discretion to decide who's eligible. I think that's really pretty critical. I think there's a piece of this that's informed decision making, and as part of you note down here at the bottom in the qualifying criteria, eligible providers must apply, those that receive designation, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if we should include something about an assessment of the management team and the governance structure in the department's judgment. Do they feel that the current team
is
appropriate for that?
Not to interrupt your train of thought, but certainly the commissioner has to maintain, you know, complete control of this process.
Yeah.
And walling it off from the political process will be a huge challenge. But it'll be a huge challenge. But I think in part what we're trying to do here is isolate and try to actually, as best we can, put a wall between the politics.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, plenty of examples. We went through the North General example. People are very,
yeah,
right? We spent $85 million on North General over 10 years. And I think the reason why we got there was because we didn't have a tangible plan, right, that we would work off of. So I understand, you know, exactly what you're saying. In terms of the management team, that will be probably one of the first things that we review.
Yes.
When New Jersey did this, they made very clear when you're going to cross the threshold with a plan, right,
yes,
and you're in that much, you know, dire straits, that's one of the first things we'll look at is that management team. And the package may very well come with a requirement that we, the health department, in collaboration with others, would, you know, may change over the board structure.
Okay. And I think if you put it in here, it gives you, you know, I mean, just sort of puts people on notice.
Yep.
So I'd love to see that and love to see that latitude for you guys. And then, Rick's comment caught my attention earlier. There are probably lots of reasons why physicians aren't designated here as vital access providers, but I think that's one of the things that got caught up in the medical community or the medical neighborhood, so there might be another way to address that. You may not want to add them as a category, but.
Pat.
I was wondering whether you had any estimate of the size of this program based on everything that you know, and you've been dealing with a lot of issues around the state, I know, but is there any way you can give us a sense of the magnitude of the program and what you think might be the duration? Because it's, you know, there's an ongoing need just based on structural problems and financing for a lot of these stuff.
Understood. I mean, I don't have, you know, a number. I really don't. I think by its very nature, we're trying to keep this, you know, flexible. One approach is to put a dollar value around the size of the pool, right? We could do something like that. If we didn't want to spend more than whatever the dollar value was, we could, you know, try to discipline ourselves saying that no more than whatever, pick a number, 50 million is, 100 million is, could ever be used for this purpose. But I think it's going to, and we intentionally, you know, when we think about, you know, hospitals or nursing homes that are in distress, we usually think about, you know, urban areas. Obviously, we know that there are plenty of rural, you know, hospitals that provide vital access. And we, you know, there was actually a bill presented to the governor to kind of change the reimbursement system for them. We hope that that would be, you know, accomplished here as well. But I understand, I don't have a number. I mean, we were initially, when we started thinking about this, we were just trying to narrow it down just to the Brooklyn situation. But we think that there's, you know, certainly in turbulent times, there could be more. Every, you know, nursing homes are having their problems, and we need to badly get them on a stable reimbursement system. So they're part of this group, too.
This is Dan.
Go ahead, Dan.
I just want to say I like the approach. I think this last point tied in with Steve and Rick's points are important in terms of trying to get at scope of it. Because last year at my retreat, I had some 40 hospital CEOs around the state, and after discussing what the financially distressed pool was like and the slipper pool was like, I said, if that's, you know, kind of the concept of safety net, how many in the room think you're safety net? And 40 people raised their hand. And in a way, they all are for their given communities. So it's very important as we go forward that the adjectives that are used here, financing mechanisms that strengthen the financial viability, right, of essential community providers. But then we include essential, and that, I think, speaks to Rick's point, that are disproportionately providing to financially vulnerable populations a high fraction of health services in their market areas, and it presumes a regional plan. So unlike the safety net concept, which the department initiated essentially, you know, in the last few months in Brooklyn, which says there's a problem of excess capacity among safety nets, how do we get it to the right size? This already presumes in my mind a right-sizing plan is in place that is going to, or that it has even been implemented. And now we can determine that even, as Scott Cooper said at the last meeting, if 100% of my patients were insured Medicaid, I'd still go under. So there's got to be, I think, an intent in our mind to realize that this has got to end up being a limited number of people who pass all of these tests. And then the help may be more than just, as was stated, an operational add-on. So it's hard to quantify it. If you can help people with capital, or if these are the kind of places we can get some money from the feds, or, you know, if they can be helped over time, you know, to partner in a less risk venture, but nevertheless a joint virtual way, if not being taken over. There's a variety of things the department can do if it's done in the context of regional help. But we can't make it look like help for those who need it only, because help for those who are going to need it in the next 4 or 5 years is going to be every hospital, nursing home, home care program in the state almost.
I would advocate as an addition, I commend you guys on really capturing the discussion from last time and really putting together a really quality proposal. Having recently participated in the unwind of the North General situation and having a little familiarity with that situation, I think that there needs to be significant financial disclosure. It doesn't have to be a circus kind of political process. It could be an after-the-fact financial disclosure of all aspects of any of these kinds of deals, including debt-related, which could be very much hidden. And I think that there needs to be fiscal monitoring of those deals in a report that's actually issued.
Yeah, I just on that point, I mean, I think that is very fair that, you know, to the extent that the department engages, you know, in these agreements with providers, that pretty much everybody knows what the deal was. Right? I mean, to the extent that we're all, again, operating under a global cap, right, we're all one big happy family, right, under whatever that, you know, we have available to spend. I think it's fair to say that if we structure these agreements, they should be part of our public process. Yes. Yep. Yep.
Other comments? I'm sorry.
I think the disclosure is great. I just want the two parties to have the latitude to make the disclosure after, yeah, to not affect other finances.
That's right.
Yeah.
I agree pretty much with everything that's been said about, I think you need to minimize it, and it's got to be very focused, and I think it should be the unusual situation that falls into that. I think it's important to have a way to solve these problems. But I also think that ultimately, if we can get all this utilization out, and if that's really our goal, is this unnecessary utilization, the only way to get a lot of savings out of that is to get some of the structure out.
Right.
And that may mean that facilities get converted to other uses. and that's a way of saving money to the system. So I just be careful that we don't continue to support areas and drain the system instead of consolidating it.
Are there other comments on the recommendation with the additional information provided here? This is a general guideline, if ever there was one, in terms of recommendations. But if there are no further comments, I would ask for the board's endorsement of the recommendation number 4. Those in favor, raise your right hand. Those opposed, thank you. Okay. So that brings us to within 1 minute of our announced timetable, by the way. Congratulations to the group. We're now ready for a discussion of next steps. John?
Yes, and I think I can pretty much do it in 1 minute. You know, our task here, and we'd like to thank everybody, you know, for the input here. We may be reaching out to particular folks here just to make sure that we captured your thoughts accurately as we, you know, draft papers and work on the principles, et cetera. But our next charge here is to write up 4 papers. We can share with you the format of those 4 papers if you're interested. You know, certainly there's a section in there on health disparity that we're required to write to, so we will do that. So our goal is to get all the papers to you no later than October 28th. For certain, October 28th, our goal will be actually to try to get them to you sooner. So as we complete them, you know, my thought would be, if everybody's amenable to this, is that as they get completed, we'll send them out rather than waiting for the, you know, one day, because we desperately want your thoughts on what goes into the paper. And in part, the November 1 date, in terms of the date that it goes to the full MRT and gets posted on the web, we know it's ambitious, but at the same time, when I was asked, my thought was that we could get there as our subcommittee when asked if that date was realistic. So, and then comments and recommendations for changes submitted to the co-chairs and work group leads by December 1. So there's a full month of comment period. Again, the MRT process, by its very nature, is very public. There was, you know, thoughts on the part of Jason in the second floor that, you know, a full month be allotted for public comment. And then the final report goes to full MRT on December 13th. Yeah.
No. Comments, questions? Other observations for the group? Thank you for your attention. We're adjourned.
Thank you. Good job.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye, Dan.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.